Our main speaker for this evening, Dave R. from San Carlos.
Lower this data. Okay. I have some notes tonight. All right. My name is Dave, and I am an alcoholic. I wanted to give thanks first to the Lord for bringing me here tonight, bringing me here sober. I wanted to give thanks to Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, to all my sponsors, and to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety. For that, I'm very grateful. And my sobriety date is October 20th, 1987, at roughly 9:30 in the morning. So, it's October 20th. That means today is actually my 6-month anniversary. So I'm 31. And 6 months, or 31 and a half years sober. So I should get a token or something. Something, though. I want to thank Randy for asking me to lead this meeting. First off, I have a couple problems with this, all right? My wife, Amy, who is here tonight, has been asked to share at this meeting twice. Twice. And they're just now getting to me. Okay? So I want to thank Randy for asking me to speak tonight. I also want to thank all those who do service. And look at this over here. This is really great. Look at all those service commitments. That, to me, is indicative of a good meeting that looks to create service positions, to get people involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. So Randy and everybody else is to be commended for running a good meeting. So thank you to all of them. I don't usually wear a jacket and a tie, okay? I'm kind of a jeans and a polo shirt, but I called Randy and I said, you know, what should I wear? And he kind of hinted, you know, that maybe a jacket and a tie would be appropriate. And I told him, you know, if he knew me when I was drinking, he'd be grateful I showed up with pants on. So, you know, I do want to acknowledge my wife, Amy, is here. My wife, Amy, is coming up on 29 years of sobriety. My daughter, Molly, is the little young lady sitting next to her who's got the headphones on, so she doesn't have to listen to her dad talk, but I want to acknowledge that she's here tonight. You know, alcoholism is a family illness. I think we're all familiar with that. My family, alcoholism, it doesn't run, it gallops, okay? I've got, my mom was an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. But it's also, sobriety and recovery can be a family thing, too. My wife is 29 years sober. My sister, Maria, will turn 30 years sober next week. My son Daniel in August will turn 10 years sober, and what I'm most proud of is my son Chris has 5 days sober tonight, so I'm very happy. I'm very happy for that. I was going to time myself. How much time have I got? Am I almost done? I don't do this very often. It's like the last time I spoke was at the Mira Mesa Alana Club about 5 or 6 years ago, so... But anyhow, I'll tell you my sad story, and you know, maybe you know, I can tell you some of the things that have helped me stay sober, you know, for a period of 31 years. I'm going to tell an old Norm Alpe joke here. I'm going to mention how long I've been sober every chance I get, okay? Because you know, sooner or later, Alcoholics Anonymous is going to get a pension program going, okay? When they do, I want to get credit for my time, okay? So anyway, so. Now I forgot where the hell I was. Oh well. I'm an alcoholic. I mentioned that, right? And I come from an alcoholic family. My mom was an alcoholic. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. My parents were wonderful people. They really were. You know, my mom, she kept just an immaculate house. My dad was one of the country's first jet fighter pilots. You know, and they were just, I mean, they're wonderful people. You know, and they had a beautiful life and a beautiful home, and the disease of alcoholism crept in and destroyed it, you know, and I always had a ringside seat. As you can imagine, there was always alcohol in the house. One of my earliest memories, I was about 3 years old, and I had an earache. How am I doing, honey? I had an earache, and my mom gave me a rum and Coke. Okay, to take away the earache. You'd be surprised how many earaches I had after that. I mean, it was a serious problem, you know. And so that's what I grew up. And some of my earliest memories after that, my parents had a lot of parties. You know, they'd have people over drinking, and you know, my sister and I would we'd work the crowd. I know some of you may have done this when you're young, but we'd go to one adult. Can I have a sip off your drink? No, you know, screw you. Oh, I got right here on my thoughts. No profanity. Okay, so I'm trying to keep no profanity tonight. That was one of my Lenten vows that lasted about 20 minutes. So anyhow, but we'd go from person to person asking for drinks off their drink, you know, and that was like when it was 5 or 6, you know. A few years after that, my mom became very ill, and she started drinking a lot, okay, and it was like really bad, you know. We did some geographics. We moved from Maryland to Arizona. And I was separated from my family for about a month. My mom and my dad moved to Arizona to get a house, and so we stayed with some friends for a couple of weeks. And I just remember that when we got to Arizona, the deterioration of my mother was shocking. Just over a course of a month, man, she had really gone downhill. I found out later that she started taking some pills in addition, so she was drinking and using drugs, at the same time. And this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but in my case, drugs deserve an honorable mention. I am an alcoholic, but I want to say something about that. Something came up at a meeting I go to the other day. Alcoholics make bad choices about drugs. That's the truth. Okay, there are people though that come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous who only drink. I said this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to be respectful of that. But I am. I did use drugs when I was drinking, and how they put it to me: alcoholics are people who can't drink or use drugs, and in Narcotics Anonymous, addicts are people who can't use drugs and drink. So it's like, I'm not going to say it's the same disease, but the end result is the same for us. This is a fatal illness. So we got to Arizona, and my mom's condition had deteriorated a lot, and she had cancer, and she was getting a lot of treatment for that as well. And the combination of all those things took its toll on her, and she developed a syndrome. It's called Korsakoff syndrome. We call it wet brain in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was just shocking to see. I mean, it was just really bad. And with wet brain or Korsakoff syndrome, what happens to the alcoholic is that your memory is shot, and you begin to you have long periods where you're in a blackout, right? And we confabulate, okay? We make up things to fill the empty spaces in our memory. And so this is in like 1968, and she was telling us that she'd had dinner with President Nixon, and that Attorney General Mitchell was coming to take her away and stuff like that. It was very shocking and scary, and it got worse. And then I remember they'd have the guys in the ambulance and the white coats would come and take her out of the house. And she'd be shrieking, and the cops would come, and there'd be fights between my mom and my dad. And this is what alcoholism does to families. And it was just like, it was so tragic, and I was so sad to see that. And it made a hell of an impression on me. I will never be like that ever. I don't want to be like that. I want to be like my dad, a fighter pilot. But it wasn't. What happened was, my mom died of cirrhosis in 1972. She was 42 years old. That's what happens. And it talks about that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 35. It says, alcoholism hits different people differently, but it can affect women, very quickly. And she was gone beyond recall in a very short time. And I remember a couple things about that. But one night I was walking out the door, and my dad was sobbing. My mom was still alive. And I said, "What's wrong?" And he goes, "Oh, your mom's an alcoholic." And that was the first time I'd ever heard, the word used in respect to her. I thought she was just crazy, but now they had a name. And then after she died, I saw the death certificate, and they said the cause of death was cirrhosis, right? So that's really just, I remember that word, cirrhosis. So after she died, I immediately started drinking a lot, and I got to backtrack, one more thing about our family. We went through a period where we had a dinner wine every night with dinner, okay? You know what it was? Mogan David 2020. Mad Dog. It was like, and I remember I'd be coming home from school, and I'd start in a little early on dinner. But as I got into high school, I put the high in high school. I really did. I started drinking every day. I don't know what happened. I had all these dreams when I was a kid growing up. I wanted to be a doctor. And I want to thank Larry for being the 10-minute speaker tonight. Larry and I, we met about a year and a half ago, and we were taking a writing class together. The difference is he's a real writer and I'm not, but I got to know Larry, and I love him, and he's a great speaker. Thank you for speaking tonight. Where was I? I wanted to be a doctor when I was growing up. I mean, I was like this little nerdy kid. I'm a nerd. I am, my idea of a good time, and my wife can verify this, my idea of a good time, nowadays is like I have a couple of my nerd friends come over and we play Dungeons and Dragons all night long on a Saturday night. That's it. Okay, that's what I am. And I've always been like that. When I was growing up, you know, before I started drinking and using drugs, I was the kind of kid you saw at high school. I'd be, you know, I had my head buried in a science book, walking down, you know, the hallway in high school, and I'd walk into a pole or something like that. Then somebody would beat me up and take my lunch money. You know, that was my life. Okay? So that's just how I was. But I really wanted to be a doctor. And I had, like, this stack of, you know, medical textbooks that I got a hold of that I was reading. That was my dream. That was my dream, to be a doctor. And then came, you know, drugs and alcohol. And I go to high school, and the first thing I do when I got there, man, is I'd cut my first period class and go find somebody who was smoking dope or drinking or something like that, you know. So, you know, I was like 15 years old, and I was already a morning drinker. You know, I thought that came much later at like age 18 or something like that. But you know, in my family, you know, alcoholism, it's a terrible illness. And it just, you know, it had me in its grips early, and I was struggling with it. I didn't even realize it. But all those dreams that I had, you know, growing up, that I'm, you know, be something someday, you know, they were gone. You know, all I cared about was, you know, get to school, you know, who's got the dope, who's got booze, who's got beer. That's all I cared about, you know. One of the things my father and I did when I was young, he had this, I'm going to tell this story. I've been told by Al that I'm not to share one story, okay? So I have one story. It's a barfing story. And I've had, my home group has told me not to share it. My sponsors have told me not to share it. My H&I panel has told me not to share it. So I'm not going to share it, but I'll tell you this story. When I was growing up, my dad had a coin collection. He kept in a little sock, you know, he put in the back of a filing cabinet. It was just like a bunch of silver dollars from like 1895 and stuff like that, you know. And that's one of the things we would do, you know, as father and son. We'd take this coin collection out. We'd lay them out there on the table, and we'd look at them. This one's from like 1895 and that sort of thing, you know. And it was really cool. I'm kind of bonded over it, right? So anyhow, so I was in school, and my mom had died. My dad was at work, you know, putting a roof over my head. And my hoodlum buddies and I decided to cut school one day, and we got some couple cases of beer and some pot. We went back to my house because there's no adults there, right? So we're having a party, and we're drinking, you know, and suddenly all the beer was gone, you know, and there was no more money, right? And so, you know, somebody said, well, I guess the party's over. And I said, I know where there's some money, right? So I went and took that, you know, that sock full of silver dollars, and I was about this tall, you know, and we went over to the local Vons. And yeah, I had a case of beer, you know, or two cases of beer, now that I recall. We put it on the counter there, and the guys kind of look at us with, you know, what the hell is this? You know, this 7-year-old is trying to buy some beer, and he's about to ask me for an ID, and I slapped those silver dollars on the counter there. He goes, sold. You know, so anyhow, so remember that story because it came back to haunt me. Anyhow, so living like that, you know, I got in a lot of trouble with the law. I got arrested a couple times. And, you know, I'm the only member of my family, besides my sister, who's ever been in jail, you know. And all this stuff was happening. I was going to jail, you know, and I was getting in trouble with the law, and I was going to court and, you know, things like that. And, you know, I dropped out of school. All my dreams were gone. You know, all I wanted to do was drink and use drugs. And a buddy of mine had gone into the Navy. And he made it sound like a great, you know, like a great thing. Oh yeah, join the Navy, see the world. You know, okay, so but I did it, right? So either join the Navy or go to jail was my choices. So I joined the Navy, and I went into the Navy, and a couple, you know, my drinking got a lot worse while I was in it, because alcoholism is a progressive illness. It always gets worse. It never gets better, you know. And so it was getting worse, you know. And I was, you know, now that I had a job, I could drink on it. You know, I could drink on the job now that I had a job. You know, and so I was, you know, a morning drinker, and I had a motorcycle, and I'd drive drunk, you know. And it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And I loved being, you know, in the Navy. It was fun. You know, there's, you know, it was like I could still show up for work, and I could do my job. You know, and I was at the submarine base at Pearl Harbor, and we had a little repair shop there. And one of my buddies, my drinking buddies, was there, and then he just disappeared. For 28 days, he disappeared, you know. And nobody would say a word about where he was, you know. For 28 days, he was gone. Now, you guys all understand the significance of the number 28, but I didn't back then. So at the end of 28 days, he came back, and he called all of us, you know, together, like the 10 of us who worked there, and he said, yeah, I want you to know that I'm an alcoholic. And that I've been, you know, at the Navy's rehab facility for the past 28 days, and I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want you guys to know where I was. And I was just amazed at his courage, you know, because I was aware at this point that my drinking was different, you know, than other people's. You know, it wasn't any different than his, but it was different than other people's, you know. But and that's, it just astounded me that this guy had the courage, you know, to sit there and tell people, you know, that, you know, there was something wrong with his drinking, you know, and that he was getting help for it, right? And so I watched what, you know, I was interested, you know, and I watched what happened to him, because I was, you know, I was already having troubles. You know, I had one hangover that lasted like 12 years, you know. And, you know, I was going to work and my eyes were always red, and it's, you know, I had this terrible problem sweating. You know, whenever I drank, man, I would just be drenched in sweat, you know. But I watched him and what happened to him, and this miraculous transformation happened in his life. You know, all of a sudden, you know, he was showing up to work bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you know. And then his uniforms were pressed, you know, and he had money in his pocket, you know. And then he got a car. Right, and then he had a girlfriend. I was like, the promises. You know? I was like, I was astounded. I was astounded. Molly's giving me a dirty look. But I was astounded at how this guy's, and you know, and he kept saying, you know, why don't you come to a meeting with me? You know, and I was at the point, you know, I wasn't at the point yet, you know, where I could envision life without alcohol. But I was intrigued by what happened to this guy. And I remembered that he had a problem with drinking, and he went to this thing called AA, right? And so I got out of the Navy in 1981, and, you know, I was going to college, and the college was a lot like high school. In fact, it was exactly like high school. I would drink before class. I was living at my dad's house, and my dad lived right around the corner from the college I was going to. So between classes, I would zip over to my dad's house and have a beer, right, and then go back to class. And I'd drink after class. The only thing I never did was drink during class, but I think if I'd kept going to college long enough, I probably would have tried that as well. Anyhow, as you can imagine, what my academic performance was like with that kind of attitude. But I got a big break in August of 1981 when President Reagan gave me a job. And that's the truth. President Reagan gave me a job. He gave me a job by firing the nation's air traffic controllers during the PACO strike. And I became an air traffic controller, and I was an air traffic controller for the next 30 years. I'd like you to think about that the next time you go flying. So, now, I got to say this. Most of that time, I was sober. Okay, for 25 years of that 30 years that I worked as an air traffic controller, I was a sober alcoholic. But I got to tell you this, I wasn't the only one. Okay, so there were others like me out there. But they were hiring air traffic controllers. My father was, you know, he was of the opinion that I was going nowhere fast in college, and he was tired of paying for it. And he suggested strongly that I take the test to be an air traffic controller, and I did, and I passed. I went to air traffic control school in Oklahoma City in the winter. Gosh, every time I ever went there until I got sober was in the winter. So maybe God was trying to tell me something. But anyhow, so I went to the academy there, and you know, I really loved that job. It was an interesting job. You know, I made it through the academy. My first airport was a little airport up in L.A. It wasn't Los Angeles International. It was a little airport. I worked at the El Monte Airport. The job was fun. It was exciting. You had the best, we worked in the control tower, right? And you had the best seat on the airport for the crashes. It was really cool, you know? And I loved that job so much, you know, but I grew to hate it, man. I hate it because I was drinking every night, you know, and they had a rule. You could not drink for 8 hours prior to performing air traffic control duties, right? Well, I was such a great controller, I figured I could, you know, drink like 7.5 hours or 7 hours or 6.5 hours because my drinking was out of control. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't. Once I take a drink, you know, the phenomenon of craving kicks in and I have to drink more. And that's the root cause of alcoholism, in my opinion. You know, that's what it is that, you know, that dooms us, you know. And I think also, this again, just my opinion, is that it's that craving that creates the obsession. The obsession is what kills us. Right, because after a period of sobriety, the obsession is what has us pick up a drink again. You know, but it's the craving that's the primary symptom, I think, of alcoholism. But anyhow, so I would drink all night and go to work. You know, and I was, I started taking geographic cures. And if there's any new people here, I'm sure you've experimented with this. But you know, this place isn't working, so I'm going to go someplace else and see if that place works. And I moved to Arizona. I was working at a busier airport in Arizona, in Phoenix, and I was drinking every night, you know, and I went to work one morning, and I was hungover, and I could barely see, you know, and I'm sitting there, it was the morning rush, and I cleared a guy for takeoff, just a small private plane, and he rolled down the runway, And I turned away to look at something else, and when I turned back, he was gone, and there was a fireball at the end of the runway. And my first thought was that I'm hungover, I'm probably drunk, and I think I just ran two airplanes together. And it turned out I hadn't done that. It wasn't my fault. What had happened was he was a student pilot. He shouldn't have been flying in the first place. He'd made a couple mistakes and crashed, and it had killed him and his wife and their 13-year-old son. But it could have been my fault because I was drunk. You know, I didn't want to be a bad controller. I didn't want to be a bad person. You know, I didn't want to steal money from my dad. I didn't want to do any of those things, you know. But I'm an alcoholic, and I have no control when I start to drink, you know. Anyhow, so, you know, they never said anything to me about the crash, and, you know, except they listened to the tapes, and good job, Dave, you know, not your fault. And then I left that airport, and I went to work at the Burbank Airport up in L.A., and that was a much busier airport. It was really, it was the big time now. I was working jet airliners and everything like that. And one of the things, how am I doing on time here? Oh, I better get sober. I've spoke before, but I've got spoke sometimes where I get, you know, like, I've got like 1 minute to get sober and tell you what's happened. so I want to keep this going here. But I went to the Burbank Airport. I was working bigger airplanes, and I was working radar for the first time. And it was one of the things they do in the FAA is they have you, you get a yearly physical, you know, flight physical, make sure you're not going to drop dead while you're working airplanes, you know. And they were starting to get, the flight surgeon was starting to get a little bit alarmed at some of my, my blood symptoms or my blood work and stuff like that. And my boss called me into his office one day, and he said, yeah, they want you to come back and take some more tests, you know. They think you might have, you know, there might be something wrong with your drinking. You know, it's like my blood ran cold, you know. Oh, my God, they're talking to me about my drinking, you know. And then, you know, so they told me, well, you got to abstain from alcohol for 30 days. I was like, 30 days? You know, I might be able to make it to the end of the shift. and then it was pretty obvious that I wasn't abstaining from alcohol. So my boss's boss called me in to talk to me about my drinking. He says, you will abstain for 30 days, right? And I, oh, yeah, don't worry, I'll abstain, you know. So I think I lasted 2 days for him. And then my boss's boss called me in to talk to me about my drinking. Now, when your boss's boss calls you in to talk to you about your drinking, it's serious, you know. And he sat me down in his office, and he had a file there, and it had my name on it, you know. And he said, "Okay, we got your flight physical here, and your liver enzymes are 360." And I said, "Well, that sounds pretty good to me." He goes, "Normal for a man your age would be 6." I said, "We think you have a drinking problem." And I assured him that I didn't. And he assured me that if I showed up drunk, he would fire me. And he kicked me out of his office. And I got on a plane and went to Vegas on a 3-day binge. And I came back the following week. And I'm sitting there in my apartment. And it's roughly 9:30 in the morning, October 20th, 1987. I'm drinking a Bud Tallboy. And the phone rings. And it's the flight surgeon, and he wants to talk to me about my drinking. I'll talk to anybody when I'm drinking. I'm a sociable guy. And so we're talking about my drinking, and, you know, I'm sitting, I would like to have had a tape of that conversation, because I'm sitting there, I don't have a drinking problem, you know, at 9:30 in the morning. And we're talking, and I just give him the alcoholic runaround. And then he says, "I think you have cirrhosis." Well, you know, and that word, you know, that's the word that I remember, you know. And it was like that moment of clarity. And I heard a voice. Like, this is the honest to God truth. Anybody know Norm? He passed away last year. He had like 60 years of sobriety. He had the same experience where he heard a voice, but it wasn't a voice in the head. You know, it was the voice in the heart. And now, here's my experience. You know, I've heard a lot of voices in my time. Okay, usually after I've taken a couple of hits of LSD. You know, but this was, like I said, it was not a voice in my head. It was a voice that came from my heart and said, "I've had enough." Right? And I think it was my higher power talking to me. And I got up and I poured that perfectly good ice cold tall Budweiser, which is my drug of choice. You know, poured it out. There was no cigarette butts in it. Not that would have stopped me from drinking it, but I poured it out. And I have not had a drink since that day. Okay, so I went the rest of that day without drinking. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I was done drinking. Right. And the next morning, I'm shaky. Right? You know how you are after one day. You know, and I remember that buddy of mine in the Navy who got on that thing called AA, right? And I wonder if it was still around, you know? And so I opened up the phone book, and here's where Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Because I'm shaky. I am really shaky. And I know it's just a matter of time before I rationalize, this time I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to drink with my left hand, okay? I'm going to close my eyes or something like that. But I called up, it turns out there was a meeting, like it was the old Burbank Angelino Club, if any of you ever got up there, 243 East Angelino. But I called up, it's like 5 minutes walking from my front door, right? And I called him up, and I said, you know, some guy answered, and I said, yeah, I need some help with my drinking problem. Do you have any literature? He goes, well, why don't you come down? We're about to have a meeting. I said, no, you know, I just want a couple of tips, you know, like, you know, get more. Well, you know, here's what my thinking was. I'm going to get more, you know, get more exercise, eat right, smoke more dope, something like that. You know? And he said, yeah. And another thing is, here's the real problem. The root problem is I do not want to be with people. People, I'm a nerd. People scare me. They scare me. You know, people scare me equally, all of you. You know, that I'm up here tonight talking is a testament to the power of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, but you know, so I'm talking to this guy and I'm just bullshitting him, and he's, you know, finally he says something to me, and he says it kind of joking. He says, you know, he says, why don't you come on down to the meeting? I go, nah. And he goes, we have coffee, right? But he said the way he said it, we have coffee. It was like a joke, you know. He was joking, and it hit me, you know, because my idea up here is that Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be a scary place, okay, and it's not going to be any fun, and it's going to be miserable. But the way he said it made it sound like maybe it won't be so bad, you know. So, all right, well, you got coffee, I'll come on down. You know, I'll grace you with my presence, you know. So I went down there, I walked, you know, actually I drove, but it was, like I said, it was 5 minutes walking from my front door. And I remember standing out in front of this hall they had there. They got the big AA sign up there, you know, AA. You know, it even had a neon light, right? But it was middle of the afternoon, but it says AA. And I'm standing out there in front of the hall, mind you, you know, in the middle of the street, under the AA sign saying, you know, I'm waiting out there, you know, going through the mental gymnastics. What am I going to do? Should I go in? Should I not? And I'm worrying that somebody's going to see me, you know, underneath the AA sign. What I could just, you know, all I have to do is go in and nobody's going to see me, you know, but... And, you know, the funny thing about that was it was nothing for me to be staggering down the streets of Burbank, California, you know, at 9 o'clock at night. You know, I never worried about anybody seeing me then, you know, but here I am getting help for my problem, you know, and I don't want anybody to see me, you know, what will they think, you know. So, but I had no place to go. I was out of options, you know, and I went in there, you know, and my life changed. It was a group like this, you know, probably not as many people, but it was, you know, older people, younger people, men, women, you know, it was just a varied group of people. And I walked in there and I sat down, and I'll never forget, it was a noon meeting, and the topic of the meeting was, how do you have fun in sobriety, right? And it blew me away, you know, the topic, how do you have fun in sobriety? Because my idea is sobriety is going to suck a lot, okay? It's really going to be bad. I'm going to white knuckle it till the day I die, and then it's, when I die, oh, thank God it's over, you know? But they're talking about, you know, they're having fun, they're doing all the stuff they're doing with their lives, right? And there, you know, I remember there was one lady, she was taking dance classes, and somebody else had learned to sail. Somebody was into mountain climbing. It's like, wow, this is when I used to sit in the bars. Now, I wasn't a bar drinker very long, but when I was, I'd sit in the bars. One of these days, I'm going to get off this bar stool, and I'm going to do this stuff. And they were doing it, you know, and they looked happy, right? And it blew me away. And I was, something about that, here was my first, I'll say this. When you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, for anybody who's new, there's a couple of hoops you have to jump through. There's a couple of fearful moments that come in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the big ones is asking somebody to be your sponsor. There's another one later down the line, doing the fifth step, the ninth step. These are all terrifying things. But I think the most terrifying moment for a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous is when everybody stands up and holds hands. Okay, I mean, for, you know, in 1987, for me, as, you know, very, you know, I'm scared of people anyhow. Now I got to hold hands with people. And they're all saying this thing called the Lord's Prayer, and I have no idea how to say the Lord's Prayer. And I know that every single person in that meeting knows that I don't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. But so I kind of mumbled it. But and that might have driven me out right there. But something inside me said, you know what? I can keep coming back, and I'll learn the words of this dumb prayer. Okay, and I, you know, so I did. I kept coming back. I was up the next night. And they're telling me, yeah, you got to get a sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. That's another thing. If you stick around a meeting, pretty soon they're going to be on you like hyenas. You know, the fanatics around here. Like, I'm a fanatic now, but the fanatics were on me. You got to get a sponsor. You get a sponsor. You got to work the steps. Get a sponsor, right? So there's this one guy. His name was Ed, and he was 3.5 years sober, and what did I know? But he seemed to be talking good AA, right? He always had a book with him, and he talked about the steps, and he came from Akron, Ohio. Of all places, which I learned by that point was the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So I decided, okay, he's going to be my sponsor, right? So I walked in. Now, again, I don't deal well with people, okay? People scare me. Ed scared me, you know? So, but I walked up to him one day and I said, Ed, "Do you sponsor people?" He goes, "Yes, I do." And I turned around and walked away. I didn't say goodbye. I didn't say thanks. I just walked away. So the next day, I got my nerve up, and I said, I walked up to Ed, "You're probably sponsoring too many people, aren't you?" He goes, "No." And so I turned around and walked away. So finally, it was a couple other iterations of that too. But finally, one day I walked out and I had to do something. I said, "Ed, will you be my sponsor?" He goes, "Oh, thank God." So he became my sponsor and he saved my life. Okay, he saved my life because he was a big book thumper. He came from Akron, Ohio, and he was raised, with that Midwestern, Alcoholics Anonymous, do this or die. Do this or die, And he got me through the steps. And that was a struggle, okay, because, again, I was afraid. I was afraid, there's a lot of stuff that wasn't very pleasant on my fourth step. And he made an appointment for me. He said, "You'll be here on this date." I think I was about 6 months sober. And he said, "You'll be at my apartment, on this date, and we'll do your fifth step." And I said, "Oh, yeah, sure, Ed, no problem," right? So that day came. I didn't even call him. I didn't even show up, nothing. And so my phone rang, and I, like a dummy, I picked it up. And if you're new, okay, let me give you a piece of advice. When you've just blown off your sponsor for your fifth step, don't answer the phone. But I did, like a dummy, and it was him. And he said, "I thought you're supposed to be here." And I came up with some, "I forgot," or "My dog ate my homework," or something like that. And he said, "Well, we just won't make any more appointments to hear your fifth step." And that, I had this guy on a pedestal a mile high. Okay, and I was there the next week. I did not miss another appointment. I did my fifth step, and that fifth step saved my life. The fifth step will save your life. It really will. As Al told me, it's amazing that just making some columns on a piece of paper, writing down some fears, and a couple things I swore I'd never tell anybody, and then telling that to another person is the most amazing thing on earth. There should be a thunderclap or something when you do your fifth step. There really should, because it's the most magical thing that's ever happened to me, one of the most magical things that's ever happened to me. I did that fifth step with him, and my life changed. It just changed. It no longer became a matter of just white knuckling. It became a matter of, what can I do for other people? So I'm sure I'm running out of time here. How much time have I got?
10 minutes.
Oh, 15. Plenty of time. Okay. So that was, I was 6 months. That was, my God. That was 31 years ago tonight, that I did that fifth step. So what's happened in the 31 years? That job that was going to fire me, they gave me promotion after promotion after promotion after promotion. I retired a respected member of the aviation community. I told everybody I worked with that I, like my friend Daryl did in the Navy, right? I told my friends at work I'm an alcoholic. And the guys that I worked with who had drinking problems would come up to me and say, "Can you take me to a meeting? Can you be my sponsor?" And so I was able to be of service there a little bit, not a lot. The thing about alcoholism that sucks is that it's a deadly disease. And we all know this. The vast majority of people with our disease die drunk. It's a sad fact. As Jesus said, many are called, but few are chosen. And what I say is, make sure you get chosen. Do the work. Make sure you get chosen. But I sponsored some guys I worked with, and there were some tragedies there, and some of those guys died. I mentioned when I wanted to be a doctor. Okay, in air traffic control, after I got sober, I got into radar, and radar was like really cool. Okay, it was just the guys with the radar scopes, right? And I'm doing that, and it's like it was fast paced, and it was. Stressful, but I learned to dig the stress. I was alive. It's like the best drug ever. It really is. To be clear-headed and to be able to do a job like that, and to be performing at the top of your game, it was like a narcotic. I loved it. And when you do like coordination on a landline with another facility, you would always give your initials at the end of your coordination, to signify that the coordination was done. My initials are DR, right? So my nickname at work became Doctor. I bring this up because this is how God came into my life and made a dream come true. Now, obviously, it was a little late in life to go to medical school, right? Okay, but he could still make it come true, okay? Because now I've got the title Doctor, okay? And even today, all my old friends at work, when they see me, we're all retired now, they're like, "Hey, Doc, how's it going?" But I got the title Doctor, which is probably all I wanted when I was a kid anyhow. But then I got promotion after promotion after promotion, right? I was making more money than a doctor was. I was making, at one point, I'm not kidding here, and I don't like to brag much, but at one point I was making more money than the vice president of the United States, who also worked for the federal government. And I did too, but I was working overtime, out, you know, like you would not believe. He gets to fly around a neat airplane and stuff like that. I did not. But, you know, so I got the title, I got the salary, and then in my spare time I'm working with alcoholics and I get to help people, which is, you know, that's like the true meaning of being a doctor. You know, so God made my doctor dream come true after a fashion. So my wife's giving me a dirty look. She wants more money if I'm a doctor. So I wanted to mention that. But I became a doctor, you know, whatever. You know, and so I was sober, and I got transferred down to San Diego in 1994. I was 7 years sober, right? I got transferred down here. And it was kind of a scary point because all my sponsor and all my friends are up there in LA, and I don't know anybody down here in San Diego. But I got down here and I found a meeting, the North Shores Alana Club down in PB, and I was going there, and people kept telling me you got to go to the Dawn Patrol, go to the Dawn Patrol. It's a morning meeting, right? And I've always been either a noon meeting or an evening meeting kind of guy, right? And I said, I don't want to go to a morning meeting. Oh, go to the Dawn Patrol. It's the best meeting in PB. And I said, one day it just happened to fit my schedule, right? So I walked into the Dawn Patrol, and I walked in there, and I saw Amy over there, and that became my new home group. So, so I wanted what she had. So, I've got some Amy stories here, so where'd Randy go? I'll teach you to ask her to share twice before you ask me to share once. What else is going to? Oh, so Amy and I asked her on a date one time. She was at a meeting, and it was her turn to share. And I love the Dawn Patrol. It was our home group for many years. But she was sharing, and she said, "You know, I'm not in a relationship right now. I'm, you know, the little antenna went boing." I'm not sure how that came out, but I was aware of what she said, that she was not in a relationship. So I asked her out. We went out on a date, and that was it. You know, it was a nice date. I took her to dinner and a movie. And here's the thing, you know, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous now. You know, I can go out and be appropriate, you know. And I wasn't pushy, I don't think. But we went out on a date, not till the third date that I get. But anyhow, and then I didn't see her for a couple weeks, and then she asked me out on a date. Right, and we went out. We went to eat sushi, and then we went across. I had a convertible Mustang, which is my big claim to fame in those days. And we went over the bridge over to Coronado, and there was we were just looking at the city lights. And I turned around and I kissed her, you know. And then I won't even discuss the third date, but we got married. And then we bought a we were just dating, and we started playing racquetball. And I have to backtrack. This guy is sponsored, had a guy who did his taxes who was in the program. I can't remember his name now. He's a retired CHP officer. He had like 400 years of sobriety. Great guy. He did my taxes, right? And he's sitting there saying, "Dave, your taxes are killing you. You know, you got to buy a house, right?" "Oh, yeah, sure, I'll buy a house. Sure thing, right?" But he gave me this gal's number, right? And so, you know, he gave me her card. She's a real estate agent, right? She says, "She'll help you out," right? So Amy and I are going to play racquetball one day. You know, we're still dating. And I'm checking my wallet to see if I have $2 for the racquetball court, right? And I see that gal's number. And just something said, "Call her up," at that moment, right? So I called her up. And she goes, "It's funny you called. I've got a house that hasn't hit the market on. I'm just ready to list it. Would you like to see it?" And it turned out it was on the way to the racquetball courts. So we went to see the house, right? We loved it. Amy wanted to spend the night there. It was this little three-bedroom place in Santee, little greenhouse with a giant tree in the front yard. And we bought it. And we became, you know, we were homeowners. And we lived there mostly peacefully for about a year. And then one day I'm in the garage doing something. And Amy comes bouncing in the garage, and she's waving something pink in her hand. And it was a pregnancy test. And it was she was pregnant. And we had our daughter was born, Olivia, who's not here tonight, which is sad because Olivia's in high school now and she's taking ASL, is her language requirement. She would have loved to see the guy with doing the sign language, but she couldn't make it tonight. But Olivia was born, and then we lived there, and then the house was getting too small, so we sold the house, okay, and we bought a big place in San Carlos, a bigger place, you know, and we moved there, and my father. was coming out to visit. Well, let me backtrack. So we bought this house, and my dad is coming out to visit us, right? And so I'm going to my morning meeting, and I was talking to a guy, Jerry L. Bill and I were talking about him. Jerry was not my sponsor, but he's heard a fifth step that I'd done. So he knew my history, right? And so I'm talking to him, and I said, yeah, and I'm just kind of, you know, bragging. I don't like to brag, but sometimes I do. And I'm talking with him, and I said, yeah, I made a bunch of money. I think about buying a new computer, selling the house. I made a bunch of money selling the house. I'm going to buy a new computer, right? I got a computer in every room in the house, including the bathroom, right? Like, I need a new computer. So Jerry, and if you're new, okay, I'm going to give you another clue, is never tell your sponsor your plan, because he's just going to mess it up, okay? So I told Jerry, I'm going to buy a computer, and he goes, yeah, that's nice, Dave. Did you ever pay your dad back for that money you took, that coin collection? It's, ugh. And my dad's coming out the next day, and I know who's behind this, okay? I know, okay? So he had me. So my dad came out, so I took $2,000, right, and I stuck it in an envelope. My dad's out there, and he's, he's there, and he's coming out to see the baby and see the new house, right? Because my dad loves me. I love my dad. I love my dad so much, you know. He kept that family together when my mom was dying and after my mom died. He did the best he could, you know, and I repaid him by stealing from him. You know, and that weighed on me, you know, and I'd made amends to my father and I'd sent him money and stuff like that, but I never told him what I did. And so my dad came out and I said, hey, Dad, let's go for a walk. And so we're walking around the neighborhood, you know, and I said, Dad, I got to tell you something. He goes, what's that, Dave? And I said, you remember that coin collection you had when I was a kid and we used to talk about it? And he goes, yeah, I wonder whatever happened to that. I said, I'm about to tell you. And I told him, and he said, he's my dad, he loves me. And he said, oh, Dave, you shouldn't have done that, but it's okay. And so I reached and I took that $2,000, it's in an envelope, right, and I handed it to him. Here, Dad, take this. He goes, what's that? I go, Dad, it's for you. And he goes, is that money? I said, yeah, Dad, it's for you. And he goes, I don't want it. I said, Dad, it's your money, take it. And he goes, I don't need it. And I looked at him, I said, Dad, I know you don't need it, but I need to give it to you. And he didn't even open it up. He just put it in his pocket. And just, we just kept, while we started changing the subject and talking about something else. So the next day, he's driving back to Phoenix, right? And he goes over to the gas station to fill his car up. You know, he's oh, yeah, Dave, give me some money. He's thinking like there's $100 in there or something like that, right? So he's putting the gas and he opens up the envelope, right? His one hair stands straight up. So Amy and I are standing in the driveway and he comes roaring up, you know, kind of parks the car on my lawn, comes waving his arms. Do you know how much money is that envelope? I go, yeah, Dad, I put it there. You know, he goes, it's too much. And I said, Dad, it's your money. You know, do what you want. You know, go to dinner, go to Vegas, get a hooker. You know, it's your money. And he kept the money. But here's the thing, okay? Because I did that I paid that debt back to my father and told him what I did, he made me the executor of his will, okay? Knowing that I would be, that I would not try and screw the family out of, their money. You know, he's still alive today. He's not, he'll be 97 in September. He plays tennis every day and has a girlfriend. And I'm going to shut up and I'm going to sit down with this. I want to thank all of you for listening to my sad story, and Alcoholics Anonymous has meant so much to me. You know, it's given me a life, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, to get help from my drinking problem. I didn't know it would give me a relationship with my father. I didn't know that, it would give me a wonderful life. It would give me great friends, guys like Larry and Al, John. And I got to say this, and I'll shut up. Dennis, my new friend here, he's not a newcomer. He's got like 9 years, but I think he misunderstood when they were asking for newcomers. He just wanted to say hi. So Dennis is not a newcomer. He's been sober a long time. But I'm grateful to have been asked to speak tonight. It's always an honor. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. And I'll be forever grateful. So thank you very much.